Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking to Eldon Taylor. We've been talking basically about mind program and subliminal programming, different kinds of persuasion. We're talking about the brain and the mind and how we basically process information and how we, in a way, kind of compartmentalize certain things in our head. And one of the things that I want to get into here a little bit later with Eldon is this idea of how to break free of the spell. If we think about it in terms of advertisements, government propaganda, what have you, how can you, basically the question is, how can you protect yourself against something that you might not be aware of? It's a very tricky and difficult thing. But there's one thing I want to ask you before that, Eldon, and that has to do with the, you mentioned some of the Playboy ads before and so forth. And the question, of course, is sex the most powerful tool to sell something or to get a message across? Or in some cases, I've heard that it's violence or fear that you mentioned before, danger or arousal. And do you know, like, you know, in an easy way, why these things are things that are helpful when it comes to these subliminal messages? They're like carriers of a message or whatever you want to term that. Why is that the case, Eldon? Why not a blue little bunny or whatever? You know, these are, you know, can you tell us about that?
Sure. And the simple answer is violence and sex are basically on par with each other. And they both create a certain level of anxiousness. And if the advertiser can create this heightened sense of arousal, this sense of anxiety, and also offer an alternative that promises to eliminate or remove that anxiety, well, then, you know, he's got to win. But it's a lot more than that. That is the simple, straightforward answer. When you look at the history of what's going on in advertising, when you look at this whole thing of mind programming, you know, you can go back a long ways, or you could just basically start with modern methods. And to me, that starts with a man by the name of Henry Bernays. Now,
yes,
you know, Bernays is the father of what we think of today as propaganda. You know, the word propaganda was the word the Catholic Church used initially to describe how they would set the record straight. This propaganda to the Catholic Church was, this is the truth and these are rumors. Henry Bernays completely redefined how we think of propaganda. Propaganda, in his book, Propaganda, indeed, he says, it's the charge of the elite, those ruling, to train the masses so that they are manageable, to guide them through the use of tools. Now, Bernays, let me dive either back up here. Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud.
Yes.
And Bernays believed that, you know, what Uncle Freud had done was give him the tools to plumbing the depths of the human mind. So utilizing the models of Freud, we could get about marketing to the unconscious. Now, marketing the unconscious is precisely what the intent of Bernays was. And he set about setting up what we come today to think of as neuromarketing, but then as scientific marketing, utilizing such things as galvanic skin response, blood pressure cuffs, simple biofeedback means, researchers would expose subjects to a number of different forms and varieties of stimuli. Stimulus. The individuals would respond, and that would be our meter by whether this was effective or not effective. Now, the underlying theory of Freud's is that contained in the id is this urge for propagation, this sexual urge, as well as the death urge. Since the id is basically the primitive aspect of the triad, as Freud laid it out, the id, the ego, and the superego. The id is the base, has the base drives, the fight, the flight, the feeding, the fornication. It also contained the knowledge of imminent death, that is, you know, the fact that you're not immortal. And so this death urge existed within the id. To test that, Bernays' people included a number of satanic and frightening or death symbols to see if indeed human beings responded as Uncle Freud had suggested they would, as surely as they did to sex. Well, the bottom line was they did. Now, whether or not the theory itself is valid is another question. I happen to give Freud great sympathy with respect to that, but there are clinicians and psychotherapists that would argue to the contrary.
Yeah.
Be that as it may, we know that, as a matter of fact, it does elicit arousal. Now, this primitive scientific research, as it was called, marketing research, millions and millions of dollars were spent. And as it became more and more sophisticated, today what we see is instead of using these primitive methods, they're using things like functional magnetic resonance imaging in a brand new field that is called neuromarketing. Now, what's that mean? Mm. Well, it means that using sophisticated means, instead of looking at your blood pressure or skin conductivity, we're now looking at how the brain is literally processing the information. So let me give you a case in point. University College London discovered in a research project using functional magnetic resonance imaging, at least as Martin Lindstrom reported it, that the Surgeon General's warning on a pack of cigarettes that says smoking may cause cancer, death, da-da-da, smoke and you die. You know what I'm talking about?
Mm, yeah, we have them up here too.
You do?
Yeah.
Great. When you show that to a smoker, the caudate nucleus, which is the reward center in the brain, or it's associated with reward, in the terms of fMRI or PET, it lights up. It shows activity, increased activity. What that means is that when you show this to a smoker, it causes a smoker to want to smoke more. Now, this is a death message.
How about
okay?
That? Yeah.
So now, what does a tobacco company do with that? It makes it larger.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, what a lot of people just don't understand, Henry, is that since the late 50s, when a fellow by the name of Benjamin Libet first conducted this research, and it's since been verified by researchers around the world, we have known that there are areas in the subconscious mind that are excited before any conscious thought. Now, Libet's examination of what is technically called cortical evoked potential led him to believe that the unconscious is giving the conscious mind what it's going to do, what its choices are going to be, or maybe just giving it motor responses, movements. Today, we say unequivocally, based on all of the research that has taken place since Libet's initial findings in the late 50s, your unconscious makes your decisions.
Yeah.
Your conscious mind is capable of cortical inhibition. But the unconscious is giving you the decision, and if you don't inhibit that impulse, that instinct, that decision, that activity, if you don't actively, consciously stop it, it's done. It's over with.
So that's really interesting. I mean, in one sense, our brain then seems to be hardwired for survival. That means that fear will always get our attention, so to speak, but to kind of the counter what seems to be kind of the weird effect of that also is that there is a death wish then in one way within the human being and the psyche that we also respond to. So are these two just different drives? Because obviously they seem to contradict each other, right?
Well, actually, I mean, yes, they seem to contradict. And then on the other hand, maybe they don't. You know, we see some very successful ads, and one that I pull apart in my book, Mind Programming, show you the color ad and then show you everything that's put into it in layer and layer and layer. Indeed, you can go to my website, ellentaylor.com, and see it all in color right there. You don't have to buy the book. You can go and you can look right at what I'm talking about. This is a whiskey ad, and there we have both the demonic and the death and we have the sexual and the propagation, and we have the taboos, those things that are considered not to be culturally acceptable but are related to evil and or sex, all embedded in one ad that most of the world has seen because it was a very, very successful ad. It appeared throughout the world in many different languages, in many different publications. Again, when we understand, Henry, that the motive is to create or heighten arousal, okay? The motive is to heighten arousal. In this instance, create some anxiety. When we heighten the arousal, what we have is a brand identification. If that brand, if what you're doing also offers a solution, like give him ideas for Christmas, okay? And what is the solution? Well, that's pretty implied, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
All right?
Yeah.
Well, and here's a better one. Here's a straightforward example out of recent media here in the United States. Maybe you had it in Europe as well, but restless leg syndrome. About 3 years ago, the airways were filled with television commercials telling us about a condition called restless leg syndrome. Now, restless leg syndrome had symptoms that most of us have experienced, legs that just don't really relax at bedtime, maybe occasional cramping, we're wiggling our toes in order to keep blood flow going there, occasional aches, and on and on and on, all right?
Mm.
So this ad presented what restless leg syndrome was. And then the ad said, we have the cure, and this is the drug, and consult with your physician, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. The incidence of restless leg syndrome in the United States skyrocketed, okay?
Oh, God.
Now, the drug, the patent on the drug expired about 16 months ago. When the patent on the drug expired, the ads came off of television, and the reports of restless leg syndrome again fell to their pre-ad levels. So if you're looking at this on a chart, like you might chart economic activity on Wall Street,
mm-hmm, yeah.
What you see is this sinusoidal function, this straight line going up and then coming straight back down.
Mm.
Now, that's the power of creating a problem that everyone identifies with and then giving them the cure.
Yeah.
And, of course, not only do they create the problem, they tell you how bad it can be if you don't get the cure. So... In the book Mind Programming, I go through compliance principles. And the idea of going through these compliance principles is to make it clear to everybody that here is the pattern, here is the template for what these people want to do in order to usher your thinking this way, your choices that way, to give you what appears to be an option, like choose between A, B, or C. Then that way you'll never see the entire alphabet because, it's just not there on the table. And among them, among these compliance principles are things like, the scarcity and the urgency. And to make a long story short, you can take them and you can set them down as a template on what is being offered to you by the advertisers or the politicians and see that they're all playing the same game.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Eldon, I want to run two names by you and see if you are familiar with them and their research and some of their stuff that they're doing. There's a guy called Clotaire Rapaille. He's kind of a marketing guru, a Frenchman living in the U.S., and he's behind something called The Code, basically examining through focus groups and whatnot to deep unconscious or subconscious desire, so to speak, in regular human beings, and then consequently trying to market or sell what he calls the code to these various companies. Have you ever heard of him or his research?
No, I'm not familiar with him, but I'm familiar with research that's similar to what you're describing, and some of it here in the United States and some of it in Mexico. And if it is what I think it is, this is simply showing you through focus groups what we say, what Frank Luntz, kind of the guy that corners that here in the States, says, are the words that work.
Yep, that's right. And that's actually the other guy I wanted to bring up to you. And maybe you can tell us just briefly a little bit about that. I know that he's behind, well, he's been working previously, at least before, primarily for the Republican Party, and he's basically behind changing terminology, because you alluded to this in the first hour as well, that it's all about your, in one way as well, then the relationship to the words and what the words imply to you. He changed things like oil drilling into energy exploration, making it sound more more friendly in a way, and it seems to be that is working, because it's all about, in one way, manipulating the perception of reality in a way through words, right?
That's exactly correct. I mean, what they do in these focus groups is they basically sophisticate the terminology that you're going to find acceptable or you're going to reject. If what I want to do is paint somebody into a corner that they don't want to be, maybe what I do is what, I mean, consider this. Our National Security Domestic Extremism Dictionary, which was released earlier this year, recalled quickly by Secretary Janet Napolitano, he essentially defined what we could see, what law enforcement, this dictionary goes to all law enforcement, by the way, what law enforcement should be watching as potential domestic extremists, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, who did they call out as domestic extremists? Now, this is a Democratic, and again, devoid of politics, the Democrats, the Republicans, they do the same thing.
That's
okay?
Right. That's
You're
right.
Right. Luntz is principally over here with the Republicans. What I'm telling you now has to do with the Democrats, all right?
Yeah.
So the Democratic Party in power rolls out this National Security Domestic Extremism Dictionary, and it says that extremists would be pro-lifers.
Hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Well, now, wait a minute. Pro-lifers are those folks that oppose abortion, and the Democrats are, okay? It says they could be returning vets. Well, you know, now wait a minute, that's the reason Napolitano recovered this, but the returning vets, it says that they could be members of the NRA, National Rifles Association.
Yeah.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, the Democrats want to do away with, the right to bear arms,
which
is a Second Amendment right in the United States,
That's right.
So what we see, at least ostensibly, appears to be a domestic extremism dictionary that corners those people that would oppose the agenda of the people writing the dictionary, places them in a generally bad light with the public, with law enforcement. Certainly, if you were a person thinking about joining the NRA, you'd think twice, wouldn't you, if you read that? I don't want to be considered an extremist. So what is happening when it's the use of the definition is to label this way is to marginalize. Here in American politics, there was a rope line incident that occurred during the campaign. And President Obama was working this rope line, and there was a plumber. His name was Joe. Did you ever hear about Joe the plumber in Sweden?
No, I can't recall that, no.
Okay. So here was Joe, and Joe said to President Obama, Congress or campaigning to be president, he said, if you get your way, you're going to be redistributing wealth. You're going to be taking my money, my tax money, and you're going to be giving it to the poor. And Obama answered that essentially by saying the famous, well, what's wrong with spreading the wealth around?
Hmm.
Okay. Now, that became a major issue for the Republican Party. They quoted it over and over again. It ran on all the different medias. It didn't run on all the different medias, but it ran on those medias that would be reporting this kind of material, all right?
Right.
We have some media that it would appear were just basically in President Obama's camp, but that's another issue. All right. Now, with that said, here's poor Joe the plumber. Suddenly, everybody, including maybe even the IRS, is investigating Joe. Joe is being compromised in every possible way. Out of the campaign headquarters of President Obama come these words about Joe the plumber. You know, Joe's really a liar. He doesn't make the kind of money he was talking about making. What I'm doing wouldn't affect Joe in any way. You know, Joe's being investigated for this and that. And so what happened to Joe the plumber is because he challenged something and got national media, he was quickly marginalized. Here in the United States right now, we have a network, Fox News, that has some opinion shows. And those opinion shows can be very negative toward our president.
Mm-hmm.
So the White House has taken the official position and has stated through more than one member that Fox is not a news network.
Okay.
That they're not, they will not deal with Fox because it's really a radio talk show program. And they have essentially, well, they have said that it's the voice of the RNC. So they've taken this news media and said, this is really just the voice of the Republican National Committee. We're not going to give them any attention. We're certainly not giving them any interviews, Now, we are seeing media in the United States stand up to that, other media, and say, no, wait a minute, hold it. This is a news organization, and this is dangerous. This is really dangerous to have the White House marginalizing a news organization. But you see, this is all definitions, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's all definitions. Now, Frank Luntz on the other side of the equation is finding all those words that will work. So, you know, when you relabel what the Democrats are doing, it is as repulsive to Democrats as it is to a Republican. And that is all seen. Listen, if you can control the definitions, you can control how people think. A long, long time ago, and we go back to Bernays. You know, Bernays in 1929 held what's known as the Light's Golden Jubilee. And in that jubilee, he celebrated the light bulb. He told the entire world that Thomas Edison invented the light bulb. Edison didn't invent the light bulb.
Tesla did.
A fellow by the name of Joseph Swan did.
Okay, I thought it was Tesla, but that's okay. That's not honorable.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, yeah, and Tesla was closer than Edison even at that.
Yeah, that's right.
But, you know, it was a fellow by the name of Joseph Swan. Now, the world, for all intent and purposes, not just the United States, largely gives Thomas Edison credit for inventing the light bulb. All a matter of how you frame these definitions, you know?
Yeah.
Our educational system here in the United States, two of the principal founders, John Dewey, Edward Thorndike, copied a Prussian model from 1819, a three-tier model. You know, and the model goes like this. If you're the working class, you're the lower, you're in this tier. If you're, you know, the class that serves the elite, the doctors, the lawyers, you're in this tier. And if you are the elite, you're in this tier. I suppose that's the Harvards and the Yales that you hear so much about, all right? Now, the bottom line to this is we have educational systems based on this model, which is not about education. The model, according to Dewey and Thorndike, is totally about socializing people. It's about teaching them their roles in life.
Yeah, that's right.
So, we get the University of Delaware, a major university, a funded university in the United States, teaching ideological re-education. They call it a treatment, quote, unquote, for students in order to correct their attitudes. And what is it they're doing? They're requiring approximately 7,000 residents, residents of the hall, students, to adopt, quote, highly specific university-approved views on issues ranging from politics to race, sexuality, sociology, moral philosophy, and environmentalism. Now, among these policies at this university, if you were born white in the United States, you must admit to being a racist. Because after all, you couldn't possibly know what it would be like to be a minority, because you were born white.
Hmm.
Now, you know, again, irrespective of your politics, irrespective of your ethics regarding this situation, the question is that what our educational system should be doing? Is that how we promote our individuality? Is that right. how we recognize who we as individuals are? Is that how we come to know ourselves?
Hmm. Oh, that's incredible, isn't it? And so this is something that is ongoing now, not only in the U.S., by the way. It's happening in Europe, up here in Sweden, too, and it seems to be at least across the board in the Western world. And so, Eldon, at this point here, I think it's good to get into a little bit on the information in terms of how we get smart to this, so to speak. How can we become aware of something that targets our unconscious and, of course, manipulates us through words and consequently change our perception? How do we become smart to subliminal programming, Eldon?
Well, you know, the very first thing is that we have to be aware that, you know, we're not really in control. You know, I think the first place to start is understand that lots of choices, lots of decisions, lots of thoughts that are going on, they're going on in you like a program written on a computer. And you fool yourself when you say, no, not me. You fool yourself when you say, you know, yeah, maybe some people, but I'm immune to that. So the first thing is to recognize that, hey, just like that saliva example, we've all been manipulated in ways. The question is, what's the extent?
Yeah. Yeah.
So the second thing to do then is control the media. You know, I'm not going to tell you to turn it off because I think, you know, there's a lot of information out there that behooves us all to be aware of, but I am going to suggest you control that media. I use a metaphor in mind programming where I give you facts and figures, but the metaphor is powerful. If you think of the mind as a trash dumpster, and anybody that walks by can just throw whatever they want to throw into it, and you just allow them to do that. You turn on your television, you turn on your handheld game, your smartphone game. You just allow whatever to go into your mind, then that becomes the programming that's in the back of your mind. It's somewhat, to get it out, it's somewhat analogous to taking a dirty garbage can, putting a garden hose in it, and just flushing it out with clean water. we are very much, I mean, we're full of a lot of material that is just not in our best interest, and it ranges from that kind of message that says you're not attractive enough, or you're too stupid, or you can never do this. It ranges from that no don't stuff that we're enculturated with to the material that's coming to us and the media. Indeed, I tell people, you know, go to your radio, get as much as you can from the radio, get as much as you can maybe from the internet and from alternative news sources. Be aware of this. If you turn on the television, the average adult in under 5 minutes will go into what is known as alpha.
Yes.
That's a brainwave state. You know, research years ago showed us that we could put people in front of a television and we could motivate them. We could say, okay, look, we want you to stay in a normal beta brainwave state. Here's your brainwave pattern, you see. And we want you to keep this above this 14 cycles per second. We don't want it to come down below 14. 8 to 14 is this alpha state. That's, you know, the same state you would have in hypnosis. We want you to stay up here. That even though you've been asked to do that, and even though maybe you've been given a cash incentive if you could, you didn't. You went into this alpha. You zoned out in front of that television. I think everybody has seen that where they speak to someone. You have to go over and shake them to get their attention. You go into this altered state of consciousness. Now, I have testified in courts of law as an expert witness on hypnosis, and I'm going to tell you the legal definition is simply this. It is a state of hyper-suggestibility.
Mm-hmm.
In that state, I can touch you with an ice cube and tell you I'm burning you, and you'll blister. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So now you're in front of this television set. You've gone into this state, and here comes a commercial that's telling you Gombu's coming to town and you're going to get it. But if you go down to your local drugstore and get XYZ, well, so what's going to happen? I mean, I've accepted this programming just like I'd accept the restless leg syndrome stuff that we talked about before. So I'm going to tell you, really be careful about television. Control the kind of media that you're putting in your mind. Try and use media that challenges you, that educates you, that provides you alternative ways of looking at the world.
Eldon, if we use the analogy of the computer that you alluded to before as well, to keep viruses out and so forth from our system, we obviously use the firewall. Is our firewall our awareness or our consciousness? Is that a fair assumption, that we need to be aware of all the inputs, so to speak, that we have into our brain, and we need to filter that through our awareness or consciousness?
Henry, that is an absolutely perfect metaphor. It can't be said any better than what you just said. It is awareness that is our firewall. And these viruses in this metaphor, this bad scripting that leads to undesirable results, this basic language that isn't even a language you're familiar with, because all you see is the screen language. This underlying language, the only way you're going to be able to change it is to first become aware of it, and then secondly, to actively go after getting rid of it. Now, that's where I go to the second point. The second point is, look, think of that garden hose that I said.
Mm-hmm.
Get as much positive information as you can, whether it's from books or audio, video, movies. Get information that's inspiring, that's uplifting, that's motivating. Gain new knowledge, new skills. Turn away from this one-minute everything fix. Realize that every minute you invest in yourself is the real investment of what your life is about.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, the bottom line is, none of us are going to take our swimming pools, our automobiles, our big houses, our degrees, our awards and diplomas. None of us are going to take any of that with us when we leave this life.
That's right.
So investing our entire, every breath that we have in accumulating these things, in chasing these things, and in trying to find happiness in these things is simply insane. When a self-defeating, I'm sorry, go ahead, Henry.
Yeah. Oh, no, go ahead.
I'm just running down a litany, if you will, in answer to your questions. You jump in anytime you want.
Yes.
And the question was, what do we do?
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
Whenever you have a self-defeating thought come in, reposition it, change it, and cancel it. So, maybe you're a smoker and you're thinking about quitting, and you say, I haven't been able to quit. Change that, will you? I haven't been able to quit up until now.
Mm.
Give yourself a new space. You get the negative, it's always get that cold. Realize that you're telling yourself you're going to get that cold. And, the research shows us, you can call it Pollyanna, you can call it expectation, you can call it Pygmalion. We have lots of terms for it, but here's the bottom line. Tell yourself that, you're going to fulfill it. The self-fulfilling prophecy. So if life sucks and then you die, you want to buy that bumper sticker, hang it on your car, well, get ready to live that way. If, on the other hand, you would like to find a cornucopia of joy, you would like to get up in the morning feeling good about life, you would like to be in charge of your own feelings and your own thoughts, well then, what you want to do is unplug from this negative, and the best way to do that is listen to your own self-talk and change how you talk to yourself. And that's, that's where I got into this business. That's why we call our products Inner Talk. But you can change how you talk to yourself by canceling these negative thoughts as they come in, by talking to yourself more positively, by using affirmations, a whole host of different ways. Okay? Then what nobody does, I love to contrast two people, Thomas Hobbes, in his book Leviathan, basically tells us that the human beings are born into the world angry and afraid. And we seek power, because power is the only way that we can escape our fear. Now, you know, Hobbes had an interesting life. The story is he was born premature because his mother happened to see the Spanish Armada about to land. It frightened her, and from that, Hobbes lived a life of fear. He's a famous political philosopher who has influenced the philosophy underlying governments throughout the Western world. In his view, we give power to the government only to protect us. In giving that power to them, we escape some fear.
Yeah.
And in escaping that fear, you know, we have someone there to take care of us. And that is the principal purpose government serves, because we're all really just fearful critters destined to die.
So
contrast to that is a man by the name of Blaise Pascal, a marvelous mathematician who resigned from mathematics, becoming a philosopher, who wrote the Pensées. And essentially, Pascal says this: you know, if you close your eyes for a minute and you just imagine that you're traveling out into space, something Einstein did to come up with his famous curvature, space curvature theory. And as you travel out into space, you see the planets and you approach each of them, and then you travel beyond the sun, and you travel beyond our solar system, and you keep traveling way out into those stars, something becomes very clear to you. And that which becomes clear to you is the magnificence of the human being, of the human creation, of this entire world that we inhabit and can know, do know. Now, I'm of the belief that the magnificence that Pascal talks about can only be had by being still. And so I encourage everyone, much like, you know, medical professionals do today, to meditate. Meditate every day. If it's only for 10 or 15 minutes, close your eyes, be still, and know. Because when you're still, you really have the opportunity to get in touch with yourself. And again, I'm going to come back and say, as far as I'm concerned, if you don't have an interest in knowing who you really are and in maximizing that in this lifetime, you don't want to buy my programming and you don't want to listen to me.
I mean, it's a very good point in terms of just trying to, well, first of all, a combination of these things, take control of what you put into your system, into your mind, into your consciousness, and try to maybe limit that as much as possible in order to get some stability on things. And as I said, to enable yourself to end up in a position where you are still and can get in touch with who you are. But also one thing I want to ask you is regarding fear, since many people are so controlled by their fear. Do you consider it to be important to also face our fears so we end up in a position where it no longer can control us? Because if we become accustomed to it and know what our fears are, basically, we become less manipulated, so to speak. Would you agree with that?
I do. But I would maybe qualify it some. Face our fear. Culturally here in the United States, face your fear, you know, that's like face the dragon. And sometimes when we do that, what we do is we make the fear larger.
Yes.
Face the fear in sense of, look, I'm going to recognize the fears that caused me to do this, you know?
Mm.
I am going to acknowledge that, hey, I snapped at my wife because I was really fearful that what she was saying was rejecting me, you know?
Yeah.
Face the fear that, you know, when somebody cut me off in traffic and I got angry, what was I getting angry about, you know? I mean, what was my fear? Oh, face the fact that somebody took something from you, even though it wasn't yours, you know, and that's an unreasonable fear. There's two things I would suggest when it comes to this exercise. First one is, remember that when you're dealing with fear, there's a counterpart, and the counterpart to that, you know, you can call it love, you can call it joy, is very, very powerful. We know from hard research that if you'll take 20 minutes a day, and a good time to do this is when you're thinking about your fears, take 20 minutes a day to think about something positive. just to rehearse a positive memory or more. Use 20 minutes in a day, maybe at the same time you're working out. So that's what I do, because, you know, you got to have your physical as well as the mental. 20 minutes to rehearse in your mind the positive things that you've experienced in your life. Just the joys, just the good memories, the things that bring smiles to your face. If you do that, you completely change your neurochemistry. When you're in fear, you're in this fight flight, you are, for all intent and purposes, repressing, inhibiting the optimal operation of your immune system, your endocrine system, and your autonomic nervous system, the ANS. If you take this 20 minutes, what happens is instead of the catecholamines building up in your system, those neurochemicals that cause aging, what you're doing is you're bathing the body with its natural opiates. The body is saying, I feel good.
Yes.
Now, think about this. The body has two budgets, analogous to a government. One is defense, and the other is growth. If you'll spend that 20 minutes, you put it into growth. Take it out of the defense mode. And what happens as a result of that is your immune system is strengthened, you live longer, you live happier, and you live healthier. It also offsets, it actually counterbalances any of the fear. It has this power to just disconnect you from fear, to put it in its proportion, if you will, so that for all intent and purposes, most of the things that we're fearful of, we discover, are synthetic. They really don't have a control over us. They're like this guy that cut us off in 5 o'clock traffic. The second thing that I suggest you do with fear is change its context. The saliva was context. Remember the 3x7 wood door? That's just context.
Yeah.
Guy cuts you off in 5 o'clock traffic. All you have to do is begin to script in your mind something like this. What if the fellow, that person that just cut you off, is hurrying to the hospital because they have a small child laying on the floorboards in the back seat of the car that's bleeding badly and they have to get there? Would you respond the same way?
Exactly. Actually, that's something I've thought about many times, out in those situations where you think like, okay, he probably has a better reason for me to hurry then, so, and try to let it go as quickly as possible and not be angry about it, you know?
That's exactly what you should do, Henry. That's a marvelous way to deal with these things. I mean, the fact of the matter is, we all of us, I believe, should be looking at our lives saying, what is it I want to get out of life? You know, do I want to live long? Do I want to be happy? Do I want to know joy? What is it I want to experience in life? And recognize that every day when we get up, we're going to engage a script. Not a lot, unlike a software program. And if that script that we engage on that given day is, I'm going to get even. I don't get even, I get evener. You know, don't mess with me. If that script on that day is, don't tread on me, you know, I'm honking my horn, I'm raising, my fist at you for cutting me off in traffic. What I'm doing is shortening my life, asking my body to get ill, because I just shut down my immune system, my endocrine system, I just threw all the fight-flight gears on, here come those neurochemicals, and, I'm probably from that predisposition going to go into my next event on edge, on muscle, as we say here, and maybe I'm not going to have my best relationships during the day. So what I've done is I've set the tone for life sucks and then you die.
You know, one thing that comes up there in regards to this is as well, for instance, for me in my position, I do expose myself, so to speak, to negative information in regards to that. I keep track on the conspiracy that goes on, and you've been alluding to this as well, of course, the fact that we're controlled by subliminal messages. We have propaganda all around us and so forth. Have you found a good way to kind of be aware of that information, be
sure,
in that environment, but still not maybe be in fear of it or in anger mode towards it?
Sure. Knowledge is not emotion. What you're doing, Henry, what I do when I'm paying attention to all this information, who's doing it, where they're doing it, how they're doing it, is it possible this, is it possible that, what I'm doing is I'm assembling information. I see that very much like I'm writing a report. I'm preparing a thesis for a college project, a master's or a dissertation. This is information that I'm not attached to. This is just information. It's not a lot different than numbers. It is not an emotion. Information becomes an emotion when I attach myself to it. If what I do is I hear bad economic news, unemployment is reaching 10% in America. If I hear that bad economic news and I say to myself as a result, oh my God, I'm in jeopardy. You know, I could lose my job, and if I lost my job, well then how would I pay my bills? If I do that, I begin to attach emotion to it. So what I want to do is I want to process the information, but I want to keep it apart from who I am, my life, and my emotion. And it's really as simple as, and it sounds overly simple, but it is as simple as what I'm saying. Now, if I were in the place where I heard the unemployment number and that meant I knew I was going to be laid off on that given day, that too is just information. That does not necessarily mean my life's coming to an end.
Yeah.
It doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to lose anything.
That's right.
You know?
That's right.
There is something that you learn in life, and something that we know from the research, and it's something that I look at as and have called for years, just the gratitude attitude. It comes down to this, you know? Whatever life is going to bring to you, you're not going to be in charge of all of that stimuli. What you do have total control over is how you respond to it. If you decide that you're going to take control over yourself, then realize that I may not be able to stop you from doing something or stop my employer from releasing me, but I can stop myself from becoming angry or anxious or fearful by simply being in the moment, by simply being who I am right now. A friend of mine, and I'll give you an example of what I'm trying to paint here. A friend of mine years ago said to me, Eldon, if you'll have a gratitude attitude, the anger and the chip on your shoulder, they'll just disappear. And this was a time when I was carrying a gun and running lie detection, and you know, my life from the outside maybe looked pretty successful because I was doing fine financially. I had some notoriety for what I was doing, kind of famous, doing what I was doing well. But in the inside, my life sucked. I mean, I couldn't make a personal relationship work. I was angry all the time, et cetera. So anyway, when she told me this, I said, okay, you know, fine. Now, how do you do that? And she said, fake it till you make it, Eldon. Just fake it till you make it. You know, whenever something comes in your life that is negative, just say to yourself, I can't wait to see what good comes from this. I said, all right, Dorothy, I'll try that.
Mm.
So I got on my new Cadillac, and I drove to my office. And as I'm pulling into the parking lot of my offices, which was a strip mall in Utah, an automobile sitting at a restaurant, an older automobile, backed out suddenly in a hurry and slammed into the side of my Cadillac. I honestly sat there. I looked at this car and I said to myself, I can't wait to see what good comes from this.
Mm.
Now, I'm going to tell you, Henry, that if I hadn't have had this conversation, I would have been out of that car. I would have been angry. I would have been shaking a finger. Well, out of that car jumps an older gentleman, and he is angry. And he is shaking his finger. How dare you hide behind me so that I would back into your new Cadillac?
Right.
So there happened to be two police officers who were coming out of the restaurant at the same time. They saw what happened. I sat in one car, and the two of us just laughed and laughed about this fellow. I don't know what his problem was. Maybe he didn't have insurance, or maybe he was. What I do know is my car was fixed by my insurance company.
Mm.
And on that given day, I learned a very valuable lesson. I could have become really upset over that, but what would I have gained?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Absolutely,
you know, instead,
right.
I still tell that story. I laugh about it. I still get joy out of it. You know, choices aren't always straightforward. Let me share another quick story with you if we have a minute.
Yes.
May I, Henry?
Yes, of course.
Okay. I want you to imagine that you've come to New York City, first time in your life, and you're visiting the Big Apple, and you're taking in the sights, and it's a glorious, beautiful day. Okay, lots of pedestrians, and so you've decided to take a side street, and you're walking down this beautiful area, high-rise condominiums on both sides. It is just beautiful. You can smell the ocean air, and you're just enjoying yourself and enjoying being alive. And from the third floor balcony, a flower pot falls, strikes you on the head, falls to the sidewalk in front of you, charge break, you know, scatter out, and so forth. Now, you know right then and there you're going to be okay, but you got a lump coming on your head, and it's abrasion, it stings, it hurts, and you've got some choices. Now, I've put this scenario to tens of thousands of people. In fact, I put it to a radio host one day. I'll tell you what he said in a minute. I said, typically, these are the answers you get. The first one is, I'm going to take this flower pot, these broken pieces, up to that person on that third floor, and I'm going to put them you know where. Of course, if you get up there and you discover he's a lineman for the New York Giants, maybe you change your mind, okay?
Right.
The second one is, you're going to sue. I mean, listen, this could be whiplash, this could be big time, you know, I am going to sue. I'm going to teach this sucker, he is going to pay for this. Now, this radio host I was telling you about earlier, he said, I'm going to do both, one and two, okay? Now, the third one, the third choice everybody always comes up with is, you know, I'm not going to let it ruin my day, I'm going to be metaphysical about it, I'm just going to go on. I mean, you know, after all, maybe the blow to my head, you know, connected some new neurons and I'm going to have a special state of enlightenment. Okay?
Right.
All right. Now, so my question to you, Henry, and it's as much rhetorical as not, is what would you do? Given this, what else can you do?
Well, that's
and
the point.
I'm going to suggest it. Go ahead.
No. Well, that is the point in one way. What can you do? It's done.
I'm going to suggest this to you, Henry.
Yeah.
What you could do is you could pick up that flower, you could take it to a florist, you could have it repotted, you could take it back to the owner, knock on the door, you know, gee, I'm sorry your flower pot fell, you know, hit me on the head, but I didn't want to see the flower die, so I wanted to repot. I hope you like the way I've repotted it for you. You could take the flower home for that matter, but think of this. At the end of the day, you put your head on the pillow. Of those scenarios, which one is going to make you feel best?
Well, the latter one, and I would add to that, that as long as you can also, I guess, in one way, influence the person that put the flower pot on that little fragile spot that which made it, you know, come down, you also want to give them some information so they make sure that it doesn't happen in the future, right? You want to try to learn from the mistakes or whatever it is that is happening so it doesn't happen again.
In a nice way, sure. Yeah. Here's your flower, and, you know, I hope this maybe want to be more careful with it. I'm sure glad it wasn't a baby in a crib. And maybe they invite you in.
See?
And maybe, you know, you have tea and crumpets.
There you go.
And maybe you find out that, you know, serendipity brought you together. There's a great story about Winston Churchill who just saved a young boy from drowning.
Hmm.
And the young boy's father had all the affluence and all the money to see that Winston Churchill got all the great schools because he came from a poor family.
Hmm. There you go.
Okay? So you never know when these things don't flower into something unimaginably rewarding. But the bottom line is, you know, if I'm going to get angry, if I'm going to throw this pot, if I'm going to chase up there, at the end of the day, life sucks and then you die. Which script are you choosing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Eldon, I have one more thing I want to run by you here, and then we can begin to round things up here for this time. And that is in regards to something that you mentioned in the first hour as well, and that was this idea that subliminal messages is something illegal, and I want to ask you then if you know if this is in some way being controlled or regulated. Is there a body out there who's actually looking at publications, media, and so forth, who actually actively is monitoring this and make sure that it isn't happening, or is it just in certain cases where someone claims that it's a subliminal that it's being brought to attention? How does this work?
Okay. Well, now the answer again is it's not illegal. There are places where there are laws or codification. The United Kingdom is working to eliminate it from television. And, you know, there are, like I say, there are rules here in the United States that the FCC has that essentially gives our Federal Communications Commission the ability to pull a radio or a TV license if they can prove that that station or network, that media outlet, intentionally caused a subliminal message to be placed in the airways. Now, here's your problem with those kinds of things. There is nobody that runs around looking for who does subliminal and who doesn't. I was involved in a case in Reno, Nevada against the group Judas Priest, where there were subliminal affirmations or statements on their album, the Stained Glass album, in particular in the song Better By You, Better Than Me. And the subliminal content there, which we demonstrated to the court to the judge's satisfaction, was a simple do it command. Do it. Do it. Mm-hmm. The overt lyrics were they encourage suicide. The subliminal message was do it. Do it. Now, two young men played this particular song over and over. They smoked a joint. They had a couple of beers. And one of them looked at the other and said, do it. They borrowed their father's shotgun, took it, borrowed it. They took it. They went to the playground next door. First one braced his shotgun, pulled the trigger, killed himself. Braced it under his head, just like the cover of the album showing a head flying off, all right?
Hmm.
First one. The second one, nervous, didn't want to. They had been chanting, do it, do it, do it. He started chanting, do it to himself. He failed to brace the shotgun. He blew the front of his face off. And that's how we know that they chanted, do it. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Now, the do it chanting was actually discovered by CBS when they deposed the school counselor who talked to the surviving young man. We didn't discover that, but we did independently discover the do it subliminal. And I testified that that was in all probability a causal factor to this double shooting. This is about as heinous as you can get. The court ruled that the subliminal message was present. CBS and Judas Priest couldn't find the original 24-track master, so we couldn't prove that the command, do it, had been actually placed on the album intentionally. They argued that it was a coincidence of sound, and Judas Priest admitted that they had put subliminal on their recordings, but not on this one.
Hmm.
The net result was these two young men killed themselves in the sellers of that particular album. Sold many, many more. There are no laws that protect you. In this case, the judge ruled that, CBS argued that subliminal communication was protected speech. Indeed, they argued in an open court that they could use it on television, and they had a right to do that. The judge ruled it wasn't protected speech under our Constitution, that indeed all speech wasn't protected any more than yelling fire in a crowded theater was protected. That was the end of the ruling. That is the first interpretation that we have in the United States that it's unconstitutional to invade someone's mind with subliminal information. I told you about the rats ad. If the power of the Democratic Party could not cause punishment against the advertising people that built the rats ad, it's not likely anybody's going to bring about punishment.
Hmm.
So your bottom line is no one's policing it for you. You have to police it yourself.
Yes.
You have to be aware that it's being done. It's being done every day. And be aware of this. those people that will tell you that we don't use it, and if we did, it wouldn't work. People I have dealt with when we've attempted to get legislation in some states. I tell you all about this in the book, Mind Programming, but the bottom line, these people have overtly stated this. A good syllogism is worth A good belly laugh is worth 1,000 syllogisms.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is they'll try and laugh it away. They'll try and make the entire subject incredulous. And in that way, the result is you won't believe that subliminal can influence you, and that's exactly what they want you to believe. So the real hoax here is to go away thinking there is no such thing as subliminal, and if there were, well, they wouldn't use it because it doesn't work. And that's the reason I wrote Mind Programming. Let me give you the smoking gun. Let me show you where it's used. Let me tell you about the government agencies that have done research with it. Let me tell you what they've testified behind closed doors and told our congressmen. Let me tell you about the laws at an international level. Let me tell you so that you can take the steps to know about all these techniques and tools, compliance principles, subliminal persuasion methods, brainwashing techniques, so that you can be in charge of you.
Very good point, and again, you can only protect yourself, and I think that that's a good thing, actually. I've really enjoyed it, Eldon. The book, again, is called Mind Programming, and the websites are progressiveawareness.com and EldonTaylor.com, where you can go to find more information about the book and pick up a copy if you are interested. Eldon does his own radio show as well, by the way, so take a look at that while you're over on those websites. Thank you very much for joining us today, Eldon. I've really enjoyed it.
It's been my pleasure. I'd love to do it with you anytime. You're a great host. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to share.
That's our second hour with Eldon Taylor. Don't miss our upcoming programs with Patrick Heron, Peter Lavenda, John Cale, and many more. Also, don't miss our video interview that we've done with David Icke on the origins and symbolism of the European Union. Really good stuff coming up. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth, and of course to you for listening. We'll be back with much more soon. My name is Henrik. Take good care.